to the Stand Up For Kids podcast. Today's guest is Justine Palmore. She's the executive director of Stand Up For Kids. And we're bringing Justine in today to talk about what it's like to lead a volunteer-driven nonprofit organization. So welcome, Justine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here today.
And I want to start you off with a question. And I obviously know who you are and I know your dedication, but what is it that really motivates you to do the work that you do leading Stand Up For Kids?
Definitely the kids and the challenge. So I am very driven. And at this point in my life, I think it's the challenge of building something from nothing. And then the overarching thing is knowing that I directly impact someone's life. So really could make or break. It could be the thing that puts them just on the right track to greatness.
Yeah. And I guess first, for somebody who doesn't know who Stand Up For Kids is, who are we and what do we do?
So Stand Up For Kids is a 30-year-old nonprofit, and we've been in Orange County for 17 years. We work with homeless and at-risk youth, and we move them from crisis to stability. And so we meet them where they're at. That may be in the street, it may be in a school setting, or it may be at one of our centers. And we work with them, and my thing is we're like a parent to, right? A guide, a coach, a mentor, and we lead them through all facets of life. And that could be from the simplest thing, getting an ID or just having someone to talk to helping them get a job and house them. And we love them until they can love themselves.
And so you mentioned a challenge and being driven. There are a lot of people that are really love challenges too, and that are also really driven. But you chose to, I would say you chose to take that motivation and drive and channel it to in a direction that a lot of people may not have done that. So from a financial perspective, so some people would take that and build a business and make a lot of money and get really rich and buy a big house. You know, I've seen you work and I know you have that drive. And if that's what you wanted to do, you could probably, you know, not that you don't have a small house or that you don't have a good standard of living already, but you chose to do something, I would say, unique in our capitalist Western society. So maybe you can speak to that a little bit.
So from a very young age, I had this motivation to help people. So I remember as a little girl, probably 9 or 10 years old, every summer doing a Ronald McDonald House, the drive, and I would set up a whole carnival on my front yard and raise money for them. And it wasn't motivated by my parents or anything. It was totally self-motivated. And that's how I grew up. In church, I was the one that brought every homeless person home, or anyone that was in a domestic violence situation. I would say, I have a couch, you can sleep there. You shouldn't be sleeping in your car, or you shouldn't be putting up with that abuse. And I would take strangers off the street. So it was natural when I got here. That's just my heart, right? And then the challenge, yes, I could have made a business. I have my own business. My husband has a business. And I didn't do this for the money, but I did go back to school for this human services because I felt like my kids were grown and I'm an accountant, so I can do my work with my eyes closed in my pajamas and make a lot of money. But I wasn't feeling like I was living a purpose. So I needed that to give back to my community and to our youth, because I think about this all the time. When I retire, these are the next leaders of our country. And if they're not on a solid foundation, what does our world look like?
And so you've got this kind of, as a kid, even this giving back mentality, but then on your first pass through life, you didn't choose to go into social services or that route. You went, I think, accounting, finance, something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My mom owned a business. My mom and dad owned their own business. And my mom taught me at an early age, because I was money motivated, how to do books, how to do accounting and run a business. And so I did go to college when I was younger. I first went to college for fashion design, and that lasted about 2 weeks. I locked my keys in my car the first day of school, and it was a far ride home. So that didn't last long. And then I was on this craze that I was going to work my way up the corporate ladder, and I didn't need to go to college. And so I waited probably till I was pregnant to go back to school with my first son, and did distance learning while I was home. And then I transferred into a regular college with my credits, and it was accounting. And I don't know why I chose that. I think it was because it was easy. It was what I knew, and I could do it fairly easily.
And so, yeah, so you did that, and you went down that route, and you had your own business at some point in there. And then at some point, you decided to branch off or adjust. When and how did that come about?
Probably in about, I want to say 2006 or 2005, 2006, I was working as a ministry leader in my church. And I was on the leadership team, and I loved working with the high schoolers. And my mentor brought me in to help her. She was a Sunday school teacher for the junior high and high school kids. And she brought me in, and I helped her plan events. And so I got really excited working with the kids. I did Sunday school with the junior high kids probably for a couple of years. And then I wanted to work with at-risk youth. And so I started a homework club for all the kids that were not doing great in school. I did some workshops on college preparation with all the families and the congregation. And so I kind of found something I was passionate about, working with teenagers.
Okay. So you had your business doing the accounting work. And then from the church perspective, that pulled you into the helping people department. Was that at the Crossing? Is that the church that you were at that point?
No, I was at a church that was called Macedonia Christian Fellowship, which later became Reach Community Church, which was taken over by Second Baptist. Now it's Second Baptist took over when our pastor retired a couple of years ago. So from there, I ended up back in school. My pastor inspired me to go to school, get a credential, because I really enjoyed that. And my first internship was with Stand Up For Kids. So once I got here, the rest was history.
Okay. And so, yeah, so Stand Up For Kids was founded in 2003 in Orange County, correct?
Yes.
So you're coming in 2006. So I guess maybe set the scene of what are you walking into in 2006 at Stand Up For Kids?
So what I walked into was about three volunteers. They did street outreach only, and it was in Anaheim. And so I lived in Laguna Niguel at that time, quite a commute. And I asked my ED at the time, would it be all right if I started a group closer to home, either Mission Viejo or Irvine? And he said, sure, if you want to do that, you can. And so the first day I interned, we got a call from the hotline, and there was a 16-year-old boy in Irvine. And so that's where I started outreach. So me and two volunteers started an outreach right there. And then he ran Anaheim with, I think it was one, maybe two volunteers.
So there was three people when you were brought in. There's an executive director, volunteer person, and two other people that are running the show at that point. And yeah. What are they actually physically doing? Are they out? Are they
doing? So what I saw them doing was they would go down to Fullerton and they would, or Anaheim, and they would meet a group of kids that were more like street kids, not really the typical kids we're seeing now. And so these are kids that some of them may have been in the streets and were comfortable already. And so they just befriended them. They would go down there, talk, and try to connect them with resources. But it wasn't really a structure. It was more building rapport, and I didn't see any movement off the street at that point.
And again, I guess in the greater picture, since Stand Up For Kids is a national organization, and How many chapters were there in 2006?
There were a lot of chapters, but they weren't like, they weren't fully operating chapters. The history of Stand Up for Kids, it was very grassroots. So a community came together. They had a couple of volunteers. They wanted to start a chapter. They could start a chapter back then. So, you know, anyone that raised their hand and was willing to do some work, they were allowed to use the name, right? And then they were guided through a process. But a lot of those chapters, when I really started getting involved in the leadership, probably around 2008, I realized that a lot of those chapters weren't really fully functioning. So we stopped saying that there were 35, yeah, 40 chapters, and really, realistically, there was probably 20.
Okay, gotcha. So there's a, I mean, it's not a, it's kind of like a franchise in a way. There's a national, yeah, entity that was founded in San Diego originally, and our HQ is in Atlanta now. And yeah, that, so Orange County is currently one of 18 chapters that we have. And so that same structure existed when you started, but
yeah,
the bar was at a lower level to be an official chapter.
Yes. So like a chapter starts, it's very organic. So that's how the organization operated. There was not a whole lot of structure. It was grassroots, on the ground, street outreach mostly. And so walking out, looking for the kid, bringing food and supplies, and trying to build a rapport to maybe encourage them to get off the streets.
Do you know in 2006 how many kids were impacted by our services in that year?
The earliest for our chapter?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, probably about 20.
20? Yeah.
15 to 20.
And how many kids did we touch last year?
400.
Okay, so 20 to 400. That's a pretty good growth rate, or pretty good statistic. So we went from a, you know, 2 to 3 volunteer person organization. So I guess maybe give us a quick snapshot of where we're at now. How many paid volunteer? What's the organization look like now?
Now we have, the last number I got was probably about 100 volunteers plus a 16 member advisory board. So 116, because they don't count them in there. We have 6.5 staff members.
Yeah. So we went from all volunteer, no money to, all right, now we've got 6 people that are full-time,
yeah,
thinking about the program, trying to make it better, actively working for our kids.
Yep. And our budget went from, you know, $24,000 to almost $600,000.
Yeah. So, all right. So help me understand how we get from A to B. So I know there are peaks and valleys along the way, definitely. So, yeah, let's go back to 2006 then. And you just started making a group and started working in Irvine. Maybe like, what's the next couple of years look like?
Building structure. So I spent probably 6 months getting to understand how the organization worked, and I did some fundraising and some marketing, and of course my internships. But I was under someone that told me from day one, if you want to do something and you're willing to do the work, you can go ahead and try it. As long as you're not asking me to do it, you can do it. Right? And so I took what I learned in school and I started implementing structure. So in the human services field, we learned case management. We learned how the hierarchy of needs, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so I started piecing together how we could make a model that got kids off the street and what we would need to put into that. And I started implementing things. So case files, I would go to every meeting and give our volunteers each use file. I would pre-write goals for them so they could work on things and kind of case manage. And so for a couple of years, I did that. When our ED left in 2008, I was basically handed a box and said, "You're it." And so whether I liked it or not, I became the ED. And from there, I had to raise our budget. I had to, you know, everything a business does. So I had to hit the ground running. And so my first 6 months as ED, all I did was focus on recruiting. I recruited, you know, 50 volunteers and trained them myself and got them working so that we could continue outreach. Because when he left, at that point, he had a new business. So the volunteers were disengaged. We weren't really seeing kids other than the ones I was seeing, right? So I had people in Anaheim that I had never really met, and they were out there asking me, "What do I do? Am I still, you know, part of the chapter?" So I had to pull together and guide them and guide my team and expand my team and get some support people under us. So I filled the roles, director of resource development and outreach, and just set up team leaders. I got two volunteers that were husband and wife to do training every month. And so we grew from there.
That's at an Orange County level at that point. And there's a national system and structure and a national board that is there as well. And, you know, at least part of their role is to provide support to the local chapters and, you know, give guidance and try to be there for the chapters. And I know you very quickly kind of rose in the ranks at a national level as well. So maybe is it the similar timing that you're really getting involved in national?
No. So it was probably, so I started as ED in 2008, and then in about 2010, 11, that was the time frame that I really started getting involved with national and the board. It was when our founder had retired, and I worked with other EDs and the executive committee. So the ED in Atlanta, Kelly Fields, and myself were kind of like the voice of the chapters with the board, and we worked with the board. I became the interim CEO for the organization probably for about 2 years. I did it as a volunteer, and I stepped down because I felt that it took away too much from our chapter at that point. I had a good team, but I didn't have paid staff or the leadership that I have now. So I felt like I was taking focus away from my real job here.
Yeah, and so nationally even, for the most part, up until very recently, it was 99% volunteer-run organization, right?
Yeah. I became a staff member probably about 4 years ago. No, 2 years I've been getting paid. And then a year before that, I took a small stipend. I was like a contractor with a small amount of money each month just to help, because I was doing less of my business and more of this. I also was a board member for probably 8 years in the national board, and helped the same way, put some structure, policies, procedures, updating manuals, helped hire fundraising staff, and helped hire recruit board members.
Yeah, so you're kind of riding two bicycles at the same time. You've got a local Orange County chapter that you could easily spend 100 hours a week improving, finding more people, growing, finding more kids, et cetera. And kind of 2008 to 2010, you that was your primary focus on taking this small startup for, you know, for better, lack of a better term, and turning it into something a little more structured and more like a business, more like a functioning organization. And then 2010, 2011, now you start to ride both bicycles and you're still trying to keep that local thing moving and happy and still reaching kids, but then trying to leverage your impact, or I don't know what your motivations were behind jumping into the national piece, but then doing a similar kind of thing from a national level so that all of the chapters kind of have a structure, more of a structure to it. So I guess maybe that's a question, is what caused you, what was the impetus for getting involved in national stuff?
So I felt that we were doing a lot of things right on the ground and we were having success here. And so I wanted to be able to share that with other chapters to strengthen them so that we were all lifted up as an organization. And then we'd be able to take on newer chapters once we all had a foundation.
Got it. And then I think probably most people have volunteered somewhere over the course of their life doing something. And so we know what being a volunteer is like, I think, for most of us. And we've been on that side of the fence, but then being on the other side of the fence where you're the leadership of a nonprofit that, you know, for many, many years relied 100% on volunteer support, that's a little different ballgame. Without being able to offer a paycheck to somebody for good work, and instead, you know, you have to offer other incentives that are not monetary for the most part, which is not an easy thing to do, to keep continuity and keep people engaged and turnover at a higher rate of a volunteer versus a staff member. So I can imagine, and I actually know from firsthand experience, that is difficult. So how do you manage that?
I think a few ways over the years, yes, people's lives gets in the way. They come in with the best intentions and they end up leaving because, you know, family dynamic change. They moving, they're doing something, someone sick in the family, their job changed. So there's always that. And I think I conditioned myself in the first year that this is going to happen. This is normal. And I need to be able to regroup really quickly. Right. So, and one thing that helped, there are a few people that have been with me. I have one woman that's been with me since probably a year after I've been here. And I know what I can count on her for. So her name is Britton, and I can count on her every year to run our Christmas party and to help me with our mailers, like merging letters and things like that. Storage, she'll store our stuff in her facilities. So I know, I try to learn what our volunteers can commit to, and then I suit the role. And I learned early on, do not give them a whole project, give them pieces and let them do step by step. This way, if they fall off, it wasn't like I was depending on this whole big project to be done and there's nothing, right? So just a couple of little things that I learned over the years. And then one thing that probably helped motivate people was I get in there with them. So I've done every job. I've cleaned the toilets. I've, you know, mentored the kids. I picked up boxes of donations and I continue to do that, right? So I never ask anybody for something that I haven't done myself. And then I learned how to delegate. I'm a delegate queen.
Yeah, and I guess you could make the analogy that volunteering, you know, managing volunteers is a little, at least at the start, it's like dating. It's like, hey, I'm a volunteer and I want to work for your organization. And then everything is give and take. So a volunteer comes to you because they want to make a difference, or they have a passion for something, and they you know, ultimately they want to see, they have reasoning behind why they're volunteering. And so you want to meet them and make sure that they are getting the fulfillment and, you know, making an impact that they are hoping to make. And if you can show them, and if they actually are making that impact, they're much more likely to stick around and continue to support you.
Yeah, another way that I made sure work was able to get done was reaching out to the colleges and using interns. So interns are, they have to be there for the grade. They most likely will produce good outcomes because they are in the field of study, human services. Our PR interns handled our social media and PR, so, and our events and fundraising. So tapping into those, you know, there's going to be some level of accountability and there's going to be some follow through there. Whereas a volunteer, maybe family came up and they're not meeting a deadline. So definitely using our interns was a great facilitator for growth and what we're able to do.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about an adversity that you dealt with. I don't have a specific situation, but you know, we eventually went from A to B. We went from, hey, we're this really small system, not touching a lot of kids over the course of the year, to okay, now we're over 400 kids a year. We've got staff. We have really moved the ball a lot. But tell me about a time in the history where things got a little rough and you had to get innovative, or you know, really dig in, or something like that.
That's a hard one.
Was there ever a time when a key staff member, like a volunteer who was working on a critical project, and we don't need to go into like massive detail, but that they then, the life changed. And you know, I work with a bunch of volunteers in my role here as well. And I get it when, hey, I've got to make a living for myself, and that is most important. And so volunteering naturally is not primary in most of our supporters' worlds, and I get that. So was there a case where that, you know, you got left in a tough spot? Or
not really, maybe with our trainers. So I had the husband and wife team. They were here for many years. They moved to Arizona and had a baby, so I had to train people for many years again. Then I found someone and they moved for a job. And so, I mean, but nothing really impacted me. I think the biggest thing that gave me a downer was when one of our graduates, who was our first employee, Brittany, left for her family business. I depended on her a lot. I also love her as family, so because I was her mentor. So that impacted me, but it didn't, you know, we had some staff in place already at that point. So I was able to recover work-wise. I think maybe I was sad.
Okay. Because, with any staff member, if there's turnover, if you've got a person trained up, and they know exactly what to do and they're doing a really good job on it, and then they leave, and then you got to find that replacement, that's difficult in any company or any business. And when you've got a volunteer run staff, I feel like that happens more often than a paid staff scenario. So two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward, one step back. And as long, you know, there's always going to be the drop-offs, but as long as you're like got a wide enough purview to see the overarching trend line, then you can kind of see past those blips.
Yeah. I so now I'm thinking, I think another thing that was very hard for this 14-year haul was never being able to find somebody to volunteer to fundraise. Nobody wants that job.
It's a hard job. I know. yeah, money. I mean, we're a nonprofit. So money, without money, I mean, even when you have a volunteer staff, I mean, one of our primary things is housing. So we've got to pay people's rent. And if we don't have money to do that, then, you know, giving them a sandwich is one thing, and we want to do that. And that's part of our mission too, is making sure people aren't going hungry and that they have clothing. And, but, you know, really, that's one piece of the pie, but housing is another big piece of the pie that we really want to be able to offer. And that takes a chunk of cash. So I guess along those lines, you know, you've been through a recession, so 2009. So did that have like a tangible impact that you can remember?
No. So I did an analysis probably a year ago from the time that I started to now, and every year our revenue increased. So there wasn't a year where we didn't see an increase. Maybe it wasn't as much as it could have been because of the recession, but it wasn't in the negative. So it's always been a positive year over year.
That's impressive. That's super impressive. Where are we at today? So let's do a little snapshot of the organization as it stands right now. And we have obviously have COVID that just threw a big wrench into our, not a wrench, but kind of, you know, made us reevaluate and reassess and adjust. And maybe you can share a little bit about the COVID adjustment.
So as far as programming?
Yeah. So we used to be physical, now we're virtual. What does that look like?
So it's all of our programs are done on Zoom or Skype, and it's, you don't get to hug the kids, you don't get to be in the same room with them, but we are, I think we're able to connect with them more times because we're not traveling, and you know, so 3 hours on the road gives you a lot more time to interact with the youth, right? And we've tried to make that a fun thing for them, not just getting on another Zoom call. So we sprinkle in topics that we work on. We have lunches with our donors to engage the kids and the donors and let them continue to work together and see the work, which has been really successful. The kids enjoy it. It seems like the donors are enjoying it, and the volunteers, you know, the volunteers from each of our corporate partners that are participating are getting a good feel too. So the kids look forward to that because right about now they're ready to go to school because they are bored as heck at home. You know, your summer and you're on lockdown isn't very fun. So we've got kids climbing the walls. Our 18 to 24 year olds, a lot of them are struggling longer than they would if the environment was open, because hiring isn't happening as fast as it may have in person. So that's a big adjustment. So we're paying more for longer periods of rent, but the kids are really trying hard. So yeah, we're meeting our kids virtually and more frequently. We're delivering food to them, which we never did before. So we're touching them again. Our volunteers are, you know, doing a porch drop, ringing the bell and stepping back 10 feet. So they get to talk from a distance. So they get to see the volunteers and still develop some kind of relationship, right? Food brings people together. Usually when we sat and had a meal, that's how we would build rapport and openness. So it's a little harder, but our virtual lunches are the best way we can continue to maintain that environment. We did graduation. We did a parade for graduation for our high school graduates. So we all got in the car. Some of us wrote on our car windows, you know, congratulations. We had balloons and lawn signs, and we try to make them still feel as special as they would if it was in person. So programming keeps going on, and we're able to expand into a new school district because we're virtual and we've learned a new thing. Right? This works. We're not spending 3 hours on the road. So we have staff hours that can be allocated to doing more programs. We have 100 volunteers and tutors that we can now match with these new kids. And so we can do more virtually.
Yeah. So I'll just piggyback on what you said. Because we're primarily a in-person group and individual meeting organization where mentoring is kind of the bread and butter of what we do and creating that caring adult relationship. And then the housing and the food and the basic needs and the career planning and the future outlook component falls in with what we call mentoring. So then Corona happens and all of the physical locations around Orange County close. And so our access to our kids goes to zero really quickly when that happened in March. And so then we had a period of adjustment to say, okay, what are we going to do? Our kids are still there. They still need us. There are probably more kids that have more needs because schools, high schools, middle schools, colleges are closed. There's resources that those schools were providing to the kids that no longer exist. So what Stand Up for Kids do to deal with those situations? And so out of that came a lot of these virtual opportunities, this We Deliver program. And to Justine's point, a groundswell of volunteer support, because virtual volunteering is so much more accessible to somebody who's got a really busy life but has an open lunch hour that they could do some mentoring or tutoring for. So we had an awesome kind of groundswell of volunteers to onboard and get going. And so our volunteer ranks are greatly increased in the last 3 months. And so we're actually, you can take glass half full, right? So a lot of adversity happened, but it caused us to adjust. And I think we're going to come out of this stronger, frankly.
Yeah. I think we'll be stronger. I think that we have really good relationships with the kids that have stuck through their mentoring and their tutoring and meeting weekly with us. So yeah, I think it's an opportunity for us for the future.
Yeah. And as you indicated, we are planning to get into more schools fall 2020. So again, with this virtual opportunity, it just gives us more hours in the day that we're not in the car driving around so that we can really maximize that time, touch more kids, be more of a support to the youth across the county. So, okay. So where's this thing headed from an Orange County perspective? We didn't spend too much time kind of the full spectrum of services and offerings that we have, but our age range is 12 to 24, and we have a broken into two pieces, a 12 to 18 kind of in-school at-risk population, and then a 18 to 24 TAE, transitional aged youth bucket. And so both of those kind of have their own components to them. What do we want? What are we trying to do as an organization?
Put ourselves out of business.
That's a good way to say it.
Put ourselves out of business, and then we'll find something else to challenge us.
Take on, yeah. So yeah, our mission is to end the cycle of youth homelessness. So once we fulfill the mission, we're done.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds bleak, but that'll be a good thing.
Yeah.
But for us as a program, I mean, we're just going to continue to dig in with our advocacy work and connecting with leaders in our senators and Congress and address important issues that affect our kids on a daily and making sure we're stewarding our donors and engaging them and recognizing them and then marketing ourselves and bringing awareness on social media and online. We have a newsletter. We'll become a household name. So people know when they need housing or they, between 12 and 24, this is the place we call.
Yep. And I feel like a lot of strides have been made in that arena. Just the awareness of that youth homelessness is an issue in Orange County is one that not everybody completely understands. And so that's one of our...
After 14 years, they still don't understand. When I started, it was a lot worse. People would not believe when you told them. And then you show them the statistics from the Board of Ed, the identified number of kids. And then in colleges, we know that they're identifying, right? And so just in our age range between college and high school, there's 31,000 people that are identified, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't count that anybody below sixth grade. So I'm going to say there's probably another 16,000 below that grade level, right? And so I think the way we continue from here is we continue to provide evidence that our programs and services are needed and work. So we're making a difference in the community, and you can see that. It's evident. And then, you know, continue to maintain and recruit, maintain, and engage our volunteers and leaders. And the same thing with staff. I think the most important thing is to continue to attract staff that's qualified and they have that same determination to do whatever it takes, because our team is that team. And so continuing in that vein, that they work with humility and drive to end youth homelessness, is important. And then making sure that we're doing our job and giving them a good experience, and giving our donors and our volunteers, the kids, a good experience so that they keep coming back.
Okay, so if I'm a listener and I just heard your perspective and everything here, and I want to help, or I want to, you know, and I'm not sure exactly where I fit or how this, you know, how I can help, but I have energy that I want to give and I want to help with this mission to end youth homelessness. What can I do?
You can email us at orangecounty@standupforkids.org, and that's spelled out orangecounty@standupforkids.org.
Yep, that's entry point. And from there, kind of tell us, hey, I want to get involved. And maybe if you have any experience or you have any ideas of what you might want to do, let us know. And then we'll get you going. Pretty quick turnaround. So, all right. Well, thank you, Justine. It's been really good. Appreciate your time today. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening today to Listen Up, the Stand Up for Kids podcast. A big thank you to our production team consisting of associate producer Billy Quinn and editors Ariba Kauka, Pablo Ortega, and Michelle Bernay. Find us on Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to support Stand Up for Kids, please share this podcast with family, friends, and colleagues. Also, check out our website at standupforkids.org/Orange County, and you can email me directly at michaelo@standupforkids.org to learn more. Please also consider a donation to help getting kids off the streets. 95 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to support our kids. I'm your host, Michael Olson, Director of Development at Stand Up for Kids Orange County. Thanks for listening and have a great day.